You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. My name is Michael Silverblatt, and today my guest is Melanie Ray Tone. She's the author, most recently, of a book of short stories from Houghton Mifflin. The book is called First Body. Of this book, two of the stories were chosen for editions of the Best American Stories collections. One, First Body, the title story by Jane Smiley. The other was chosen by John Edgar Wideman for the current year's volume. She has been named this year by Granta Magazine one of the best young American novelists, so it's been a very good year. The previous novel is Iona Moon. The collection that preceded that is Girls in the Grass, and the first novel was Meteors in August. Now, I wanted in particular in this interview to talk about the way a short story is made, and I wondered if you could tell me about how you proceed.
Well, I think it started when I was working on Iona Moon, and I didn't really understand the people in that story yet. I understood some of them, and I knew some of the events. And I kept asking myself questions about them, like, what happens when Iona goes to the barn in the morning to milk the cows? And what happens when she goes up to talk to her mother? And why is her mother in bed? And why does Iona have to do this work? So it was a process of uncovering the mysteries of my people's lives. And as I worked on that novel, I followed that through with all of my characters. I always had a series of questions. What happens now and what happens now in this situation? We're in a new place. One of the people works in a funeral parlor. And so I was thinking, well, how does she think about her son when he comes home late, if she's been someone who has worked with people who come home too late? So that's how it worked for me in the beginning, was just these little pieces would come to me, these shards, and it wouldn't be the whole story, and it wouldn't be a narrative line. It would just be these pieces of information coming from different places.
Now, I want to, though, distinguish between what you do and what other writers do. I want listeners to know something of what characterizes a story by Melanie Ray Tone. For instance, all writers want to know about their characters if they're doing character-driven pieces. But in your stories, I think of the characters as being revealed by vectors of forces. These characters are not so much revealed as they are pulled apart. The opening character in First Body, in this new collection, we see him dying. We see him being born, figuratively or metaphorically. He's coming out from a woman who he imagines as a marsh. There's a sense that everything that happens in a life is going to happen in some way to the central character in this story. These are not the usual questions an author asks, like, how many children does he have? What color is her hair? What is he like for breakfast? These are like eschatological questions of birth and death.
I'm trying to imagine that person's particular experiences. For instance, with Sid Elliott, I mean, one of the first things that I began to imagine about him was just his size. And he was at least twice as big as I am. So I started trying to imagine, well, what is it like to be in a body of that size? And how is a person's life different if you live in that particular body? So I think I'm very interested in getting inside those really private places, not understanding necessarily the circumstances of someone's life as much as the internal world and the way the world's perceived through that.
Well, then, having imagined someone bigger than you for the hero of First Body, you then imagine a woman bigger than him. He is working in a morgue, and he is going to be attempting to move a woman dead of 326 pounds. He wants to respect her, so he doesn't want to simply plop her or turn her over, and he ends up incapacitated and immobilized beneath her, which leads to a passage that virtually recapitulates birth trauma. I know something of how you think of your characters, but I don't think you know how I think of your stories. And for some reason, the effect for me is something like, say, Picasso's Guernica. In the right-hand corner, there'll be a woman shrieking who is the consummate intensification of the mourning and wailing that it would be a response to war. There's a woman with a dead baby in her arms, and she's simultaneously nursing it and screaming in lamentation over it. There's a sense that here in this canvas, this Picasso canvas, is going to be both the particular and the universal of response. And so I think in, for instance, just since it's to hand the first story, first body, there are copters. They are the copters that Sid has encountered in Vietnam. But they are also waiting on the roof of the hospital to take hearts in ice, the story tells us, and corneas in milk to other bodies that may need them. The image keeps growing. In the next story in the book, a woman is describing her lovers, one of whom tells her, "I've loaded bodies into copters. Sometimes they're all dead." And so the image keeps growing, not only within the story, but from story to story, and conflates. This is what I think of as most characteristic and individual of your techniques.
That's a wonderful perception of it. It's really interesting to hear you say that. Because I don't necessarily think in those grand ways. I mean, it's very exciting to me to hear that kind of analysis of it. And I do play certain themes over and over, and I think it is that sense of being awed by the miraculous and the way that chance plays in the miraculous, so that sometimes you take this piece of one body and give it to another body, and there's transubstantiation, mm-hmm. as Sid says. And sometimes all of the young men in the helicopter are dead because of the war. And who decides how that happens? No one decides, obviously. And I think I have a sense of just absolute awe.
I'm speaking to Melanie Rayton. I'm talking about her book of stories, First Body. In the second story, for instance, Father, Lover, Dead Man, Dreamer, the woman who narrates the story, what is her name?
Ada.
Ada, that's right. And her mother is Noelle. She says at one point, she's sitting between her mother and father in a truck after the father's gone to search for the missing mother who likes to dance all night. She says, "I was the silence between them." But that silence is filled by a preternatural knowledge she has. Your characters, if their truck is hit, will feel it in their kidney. You know, she feels her father's pain. She feels her mother's disappearance. These are not the usual physical afflictions. Since this book is about the body, it's about raising the concept of the body until it nearly feels everything it's possible to feel.
There's a wonderful Eastern idea. It's very antithetical to our Western conception about identity and about our knowledge of ourselves. And in many Eastern religions, there's this idea that that the self doesn't really exist, that the self keeps responding to external forces, but that the body does preserve memory, and that that is where memory and individuality and knowledge is stored, but we don't have access to it in language.
Do you think of these stories as mystical? Because I do.
I guess I do in a certain way, in that for me, the process of trying to take that leap, trying to understand someone who really isn't me, and trying to get into another person's skin, literally, it changes me. If I do it honestly, it changes me. And that's always my question at the end of a story, not is it any good or can I sell it or will people like this, but did the journey take me somewhere that I hadn't gone before? And in that way, it does seem mystical.
Because, you know, all of these stories, at first I wanted to make an exception, but no, all of them begin with the calamity of the physical.
Mm-hmm.
The physical world is imploding, whether because the characters are in withdrawal or because there's been a terrible accident. Calamity is the place of the beginning. And I think of this catastrophe as opening up the possibility for what? Revelation and nearly violent mutation. That this is how these stories tend to work. The catastrophe takes these characters into a state that, for lack of a better, more aware term, I'll call a spiritual state, in which anything is possible to them.
I think that's true. I think that's a really accurate understanding of where those stories came from. I think sometimes that it does take a severe kind of breaking open of any kind. I mean, it could be emotional as well as physical, but I think very often the physical calamity catapults us into another level of awareness.
Now, I'm aware that these stories are, in a sense, variations of the possibility of the body in danger. And one of the stories, which is called, is it Forms of Water?
Bodies of Water.
Suddenly we're considering the body in the light that, like the globe, it is made up principally of H2O. And it's almost as if in these stories, aspects of the body occur to you and they become the basis for transformation in a story. Am I making you more of a poet than you think of yourself?
No. I love thinking of it this way. It's great. Yeah, in that particular story, I really was interested in that idea that the body is almost entirely water, and you know, there's this horrible rainstorm going on. So there is this confusion for the woman in the story. Is there an intruder in my house or is there not? And with these sounds of the rain going on, how is a body different from the rain if there's only that 10% difference?
Landscape is very important to you, but it's not described literally. How do you take it in?
Oh, I think I do describe it literally.
That'll show me.
Yeah. which is always the interesting thing, you know, people think with Van Gogh or Monet or something, how did you manage to see that? When they say, well, that's how it really looked to me. And I think when I'm describing landscape, that is how I perceive landscape. And certainly, one of the descriptions I'm thinking of right now is the one at the end in Necessary Angels, which was in Florida. And the landscape, to me, really is that intense, you know, that you grab a piece of grass and it cuts your hand. That's literally true.
But if it didn't cut your hand, it wouldn't have been good for your story.
That's true.
And you have chosen the detail that will bite.
Right.
The detail that will read as if you dreamed it rather than saw it.
Yeah, and maybe it is a filtering out of the ordinary, so the extraordinary moments collapse in on one another.
You see, these are, thank you, that's perfect, you know, these are the extraordinary states of mind of ordinary people. And it's as if each of these stories is like, what would you say, a uterine sac combined with a coffin for the character contained within. That this is a birth-to-death story in a single, apparently event-filled story. For instance, story number two, the one we just talked about. It's a story in which a daughter narrates her life with her father, but what we come to know is that her life with her father has replicated her mother's life with her father. She doesn't know this at the beginning of the story. What the story is literally about is how she accidentally killed a man when driving home from a 4th of July picnic, and how her father concealed, one thinks, the evidence of this. It brings up another of your constant themes. What would I call it? The casual racism of everyday life. The man killed is a Native American. And yet what is revealed has something to do with the Holy Father and Jesus Christ, the relationship between God and his children and their guilt. This is a startling, startling method, you see, and that's why I can't let a writer like you escape by suggesting that you're trying to know what your characters would wear. I know you know that, but you know much more as well.
Yeah, I guess there's this wonderful, wonderful quotation in Frank Bidart writing as Nijinsky, and he says, "I know people's faults because in my soul I have committed them." And I think that's part of it, is really allowing yourself to enter someone else's world and imagination fully enough so that you're right down there with them as they go through these experiences. And that's when I begin to see those kinds of things. So that when Ada is struggling with this memory and her own rage about Catholicism, one of the things she's thinking about is, you know, this hunting accident that took place near where she lived, where a father accidentally shot his own son, and she's comparing that to God putting Jesus to death on the cross, and she's enraged about that. But later on, she comes to see the child's flaws through her own failings.
What is responsible for the condition of these people's lives?
Oh, I'm not sure. I mean, I think many things. Part of it is that choice to be in that landscape. I mean, at some point, the characters have gotten themselves there. But if you're born into it, then how do you know enough to escape it? And I think many of the people that I write about are in very extreme places. But I grew up in Montana. that's it. So I was very aware of what is it like when you go out in the morning and the wind chill is minus 35. And you have to go out and milk the cows. The cows can't wait. Mm-hmm. So there's a sort of harshness, but there's also the people who live in that environment don't think of it as harsh necessarily. They just think of it as, this is how I live.
Mm-hmm. This is how I live seems to be, no matter how intense these characters become. There's a story, it's another one of the Best American Stories, what is it called?
Christmas Jamaica Plain.
In which the people in the story are housebreakers, drug addicts, hoping for transsexual operations, and, you know, it's a motley crew. Now, some writers, when asked what is responsible for the lives of these people, would answer, they are. They're responsible. Mm. But I suspect that would be very far from your answer.
Yeah, when it's so complicated with those two. With with Nadine, I think that many of the things that are responsible are things that aren't in her control at all. She has a mother who's been married several times who, you know, at one point Nadine's tracing her mother's history and she's saying, how many lovers can one woman have? How many children how many children can pass through one woman? And she has a sympathy and an empathy for her mother, but also a tremendous amount of rage toward what her life is. But that doesn't mean that Nadine is without choice. But I think she's affected by people outside of her as well. She's affected by her sister who chose to run away. And if you've got an older sister who chooses a certain kind of option, you go, oh, okay, I can do that too. And so I think many things can influence an individual life. For Emile is a beautiful boy who wishes that he were a woman. And to live, to be born into the wrong body is a torment that's very difficult for most people to imagine. And so to say, well, his problems are his fault, we just can't say that. I think I was really influenced when I read Oliver Sacks' book, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. And you start to realize the tremendous range of neurological and physical differences that people can have. And this idea that, well, we can choose a certain path, that may be very true for some people, but not for others.
I wondered, when you say compassion and rage, these do seem to be the sympathy and rage, was what you said. The poles, the essential poles of these stories, they're linked with other words that I find in the stories themselves. Sympathy is linked with vulnerability, the vulnerability to feel deeply into another person's life that comes as a result of a personal vulnerability. And rage seems to be, in a sense, the consequence of understanding helplessness, that rage here is not the externalized rage of a destructive person, but of someone who, because of sympathy, knows what has to stay bottled up. And I wondered if you could speak of those qualities, what would you say, technically in the writing of fiction. How do you work within those parameters?
You know, I never think in the abstract when I'm making a story. I'm always thinking in such specific terms that it's only later that I might put that kind of language to the story and say, oh, that's what I was working with, or I was trying to move between those poles. But as you're talking, the story I'm thinking about is Little White Sister, where
that's
black man...
Yeah.
Oh, good. See, we're on the same wavelength. The man in that story sees a white, as a black man, he sees a white woman in trouble and he chooses not to help her. And he has this incredible rage about racial injustice, and with good reason. And he has many incidents in his own life that have led him to that feeling. And he thinks, if I go out there and help her, I'm just going to get myself in trouble. And he has every reason to think that as well. And it isn't as if he makes a decision that any of us could judge as the wrong decision. But what's wrong about it for him is that he comes to know her and comes to sympathize with her and comes to identify with her and understand that her suffering might be very similar to his, even though she's a white woman and he's a black man. And as when he begins to feel that sympathy, as you say, it makes him tremendously vulnerable, and he no longer has the protection of rage, which keeps us separate.
He's feeling these feelings. Is it 20 years later that he's telling the story in that case? And in many cases, these stories are told by people who are experiencing their intensities long after the events described. And I wondered why that is.
Well, the events in that are really mixed, because the woman had actually died just, you know, that was a recent event, but it's fused with these other events in his life. And I think that that's something that really happens, too, at the point. If you have a calamity of some kind, if you have something that that severs the normal course of your existence so that you can no longer live safely within your routine, that many things may start collapsing into that moment,
mm-hmm.
so that you're remembering not only what happened last night when you, or 4 nights ago when you didn't help that woman, but what happened 20 years ago and what happened 10 years ago and what happened when you were 2 years old, that you can't stop those images from firing off in your head. They're the ones that you've suppressed. They're the ones that you've tried to contain and manage and put in a neat narrative form. But when you're suffering, when something jolts you out of that safe routine, suddenly they're all back on the surface and they're all happening at once again.
Flannery O'Connor, of course, when we talk about her art, we find ourselves talking in those terms that she gave us of mystery and manners. And I wondered if you have, for yourself, a phrase that defines the permanence of a short story.
The permanence of a short story?
When one asked, you know, O'Connor what stories ultimately are about, she would say mysteries and manners, mm-hmm. and she might as well have said miracles in the ordinary, or miracles in how we respond to them, or miracles, better still, that we don't recognize as miracles, that may look like horrific nightmares. But it was almost as if when she gave that answer, she was crystallizing what she'd done.
Yeah, I think that's true. I'm not sure I have it distilled in that way. I mean, I think in my stories there are certain things that I keep striving for, and I think right now I'm thinking they're about suffering and grace.
Suffering and grace. There is a religious aspect. How do you define grace?
I think that grace is found in the capacity to still want to love. We might not always be able to find an object for that love, and the people that we choose to love might not be receptive to it or worthy of it, but I think what I find miraculous in people and the people whom I choose to write about is that no matter how much they suffer, they still have this capacity to love someone, to want to love someone. So even at their most despairing moment, they're feeling compassion for another human life. And I think that as long as we feel compassion, we have access to grace.
I've been speaking to Melanie Raitone on the occasion of the publication of her new book of short stories, First Body, published by Houghton Mifflin. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Michael.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Jennifer Swadek. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's Book of the Mouse Pop Time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.